In the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. We're going to go in reverse order here today and start out with a public hearing and a work session on House Bill 2684. And Representative Smith Warner is here. Before we hear from Representative Smith Warner, can we get a quick briefing on this issue? And I know the two gents to my right are familiar with this already, but go ahead.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2684A repeals the gigabit portion of Senate Bill 611, which provides a property tax exemption for the intangible property on communication infrastructure companies that provide gigabit services. And the amendment in the dash A allows that the currently eligible company would get 75% assessment for 1 year only before the repeal.
Representative, thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me here, Senator House. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner, and I have the honor to represent House District 45, which is Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. And I am here on behalf of my colleague, and I believe he's the chief sponsor, Representative Nose, who could not join me here today. Indeed, I know everyone on the dais before me is fairly familiar with Senate Bill 611 and the evolution over time. I'm actually going to not do all of, I'm a written testimony testifier, but I'm not going to do all my written testimony. I just want to say that this is something, this is kind of an unintended consequence from a very specific thing we are writing policy to, behavior we are trying to incentivize, that even though that didn't happen, we have created this exemption that potentially with new technology coming up, 5G and other things, has the potential to go way out of proportion. So we have been, since not long after this passed, trying to manage this exemption. We did some work in 2017. They did not pass, and so I'm happy to say that this session we are back before you with this gigabit exemption, and through some hard work in the House committee, we were able to pass the, we got the one remaining company who was impacted by this to neutral on the bill. It passed unanimously out of the House, and I believe unanimously out of the House Revenue Committee, as well as, I believe, unanimously off the floor of the House. And I am eager for you in the Senate to work it and pass it today. I will just say my kind of read through a little bit of the ending of my testimony, which is as technology changes at a lightning fast speed, sometimes the solutions that we as legislators create aren't able to keep up with the details and scope that the technology and corresponding infrastructure needs. This was the case with the gigabit property tax exemption in past sessions, and we can take an important step toward remedying that misstep today. This bill was amended so that it would allow a company that received approval from the PUC before March 2016, operates a qualifying project, and is not in a tax controversy with the Department of Revenue to have their intangible property assessed at 75% of the real market value. This assessment would apply just for the 2019-2020 property tax year, then it will sunset permanently. I do believe that broadband access is the rural electrification of the 21st century. I talk with my relatives in Baker City frequently about how essential it is for rural Oregon to have the chance to participate in the global economy and community, and I continue to support efforts to make it widely and affordably available. However, the gigabit exemption is not part of that solution, and I urge this committee to implement this policy to protect taxpayer funds by voting yes on House Bill 2684 today. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Seemed like a good idea at the time.
Sure did.
Any questions, Senator Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you know how much money the one company that seemed to take advantage of this, that perhaps is being benefited by the amendment, enjoyed in the form of the exemption, the total?
I believe, and I believe LRO staff might have, because I don't have my computer before me, may have better access to this. I believe they qualified and received one full year's worth at somewhere between $2 and $3 million. And this will give them an additional one quarter's worth of that, although we don't know exactly yet because the amount you get each year depends on your overall intangible assessment. But the estimate is somewhere between $500,000 and $750,000. Is that right, Jamie? Yes. So
there is a revenue estimate in all this.
Oh, thanks. And there's a revenue estimate in all its Senator Benz.
Mm-hmm. We have a revenue impact statement. And Isaac can pull that up.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Senator Benz.
Does that revenue impact statement reflect previous years or just looking forward?
Probably just looking forward, Mr. Chair. Representative Benz, yeah. And the one I can vouch for that you can find in PUC documents as well was the 1 year that they did receive it. There's a whole, I spent a lot of time with a lot of PUC reports earlier this session, and it was a very lined out thing. Each year's report was who qualified that year, and then what investments they had made to each of those years, whether DOR accepted that. So it was a couple year process before Frontier, which is the one company that did end up taking advantage of this, both applied saying they could do it and then actually did the work, offered the service, and then qualified for the tax year and then received it for that first year in which they met all the qualifications. And that amount was about, like I said, about 2.7 million.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Benz.
Thank you. So the question that we had in the past when we debated this many times was the comparison of the two numbers, A, what they spent when they put the project in, the infrastructure in, and B, how much the state put up to offset that cost. So how much did they put in?
Well, that's a great question, Senator Benz. Mr. Chair, Senator Benz. In my research and in my discussions with the company, it came out, and I believe they testified to this in the House side, that the numbers, the investment that was reported to the PUC did not match up with the investment that the company reported to the Revenue Committee. And as it turned out, they, after this discrepancy came up, I believe they were planning on amending their report, but it depended on which set of numbers you looked at. They did not get a one-to-one return. When I first started looking, I estimated that they were going to end up getting about 60 to 70% back over, or that they already had in their 1 year. They argued that they had used, that they had more investment that was not reflected in the PUC filings, to which I said, well, all we have to go on is the PUC filings about what you did invest. And so even with that, I could not give you a percentage right now, but I know it was not 100%. They did not get fully recompensed for what they invested. And I would also note that they were advertising gigabit service provision before that bill took effect. They continue to offer it to other customers. And because I am not adept enough at understanding that technology, we've had a series of conversations about how much of the investment they could use for that that symmetrical gigabit download and upload they were going to be able to repurpose for other of their clients that also had those requirements but that weren't business, didn't necessarily need symmetrical, et cetera.
Well, Mr. Chair, so there was Chair Barnhart and I both appeared. He actually testified. I chose not to because I was appearing by video conference before the PUC on this issue, and it had to do with the nature of the credit that was going to be, or the eligibility, if you will, for the deduction. So the question, one of the questions that was asked was how much was being charged per customer, and so the did you ever get to that? Because I recall that there was quite a large variation under the term was service available, and then we got in a big argument over quote available end quote because the cost in some cases was $700 a month, some crazy number from how many years ago this was. I barely remember it. So anyway, I'm supportive of this bill.
I know.
So you know.
Same place that I got to.
Right. But I just want to go back through these concepts.
Yes. So Chair Haas, Senator Bentz, the idea of this being the way this was implemented, it was this multi-step qualification process where, first of all, you had to prove that you could provide symmetrical gigabit service. And so, again, I really did spend quite a weekend pretty much just reading PUC reports. Originally there were two companies that demonstrated that they would be able to provide this service. One of them, the Frontier, had to demonstrate it theoretically because they didn't actually have it yet. And so they demonstrated that they had engineers testify that they would be able to provide it. And so the PUC said, okay, yes, when you are implementing that and following the rest of the requirements of this bill, then indeed that is a qualifying project. So then they went forward, did the investment, put it in, and then started offering it to, and the other elements of being able to receive this was you needed to be offering the service, and there weren't any requirements about how much or how many people chose to take it up, but you had to be offering it to a majority, I believe it was just a majority, more than half of your customers. And so that service, it wasn't until December of, I think, 2016 that they were offering it to that. And so the Department of Revenue said, well, you were not offering it because you didn't start it until December of that year, you don't qualify for that year. The year after, they were still offering it to more than half of their, it was available technically to more than half of their customers. And so that was the first year that the DOR said, yes, that's fine, you qualify, we will let you do that. The continuing issue was how much were they charging, how many people were actually using it. There was a question of whether the amount of customers they had for this was out of the single digits. And as you mentioned, what the price was, that was not ultimately required to be part of the PUC reporting. And so I'm not sure we got to that officially, but indeed all of those things were elements. My colleague, Representative Reschke commented when we moved this out of the House committee that he thought it was a good example of even when indeed we think that we are tightening the requirements we have in order to get a tax credit, even sometimes in this case, by putting in kind of a double backup. First, you had to get approved by the PUC for your project, and then DOR, the Department of Revenue, had to approve you for the actual credit or intangible allotment. Even then, it was confusing because there were conflicts between the interpretations that the two different agencies had. So I would argue more than that, it was also an example of we really do need to be extremely specific about what our policy goals are that we are trying to accomplish. Did we, you know, and I'll just stop there. But I would be happy to come to your office with those PUC reports and walk you through them. I actually have an excellent one-page memo that I'm going to send you whether you want it or not.
A lot of that happening lately.
I'll send that to you as well, Senator Boquist.
I'm in favor too, just so you know.
Okay. Senator Taylor.
No, Chair, I was wondering what the response was going to be from Senator Bentz. So
is that memo or not?
Well, I have another question, Mr. Chair, but I'm not sure who's following to the next person up is, I guess, my question. That might be able to address these issues. The question I have, I think I already asked, which was how much did getting Frontier to neutral cost as opposed to not being enthusiastic about that additional time?
Sure. Sorry. So that is the revenue impact statement for this.
If this bill passes, there'll be a revenue gain in the first biennium of 4.7.
Oh, thank you. I think I could get if you gave me a minute, I could tell you what the estimation of what a quarter of 1 year's credit is for Frontier, who is the one remaining. I can find that out for you over the course of this hearing, I bet. Or maybe Jamie could.
One last remark. What I'm trying to get at is what did we get and what did we pay? That's all I want to know. Pretty simple. And again, Is there some part of this that's in litigation? Is that why this has been drawn? This is it. Frontier is the only
Correct. They are the only they are the only company with a qualifying project right now. And if we do this and have this exemption end on June 30th of this year, no one else will be able to submit a potentially qualifying project to the PUC. And Frontier, and it will expire at the end of June of this year. No one else will be able to do it going forward, and Frontier will no longer be able to claim it.
Yeah, and my question was
closer to the answer.
What did we get, and how much did we pay?
Gotcha.
That's what I want to know.
Okay.
We don't have the answer. We don't have the answer yet.
Well, I would question what you mean by get.
Actually, I would be, Mr. Chair, I would be happy just by knowing what we paid.
Yeah.
Then we can talk about what we got.
Sure. I would say, and I again, I can do this from the PUC, the company got about $6 million in the one-year exemption, and I believe they're qualifying for about $600,000 for the second. So it'll end up being a little over $3 million that was decreased from their intangible asset allocation, and therefore they had tax relief from.
Does that satisfy you, Senator Benz? Or yep. We do have our property tax guru, Mark Garst, on deck, standing by.
Then, next man up.
Mr. Garst. No, he wasn't signed up, but
He's volunteered to come bail the representative out.
Thank you.
Chair House, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Department of Revenue. And so I just have the PUC report here that Representative Smith Warner, who did just a great job there, was pointing to. And the impact that was listed for the 2018-19 tax year, property taxes not imposed, was $2.57 million. And so if you take about 25% of that, just assuming that the value is going to be similar this year, it's $650,000 or so. And you may see a small increase, you may see a small decrease. It depends on what the value of the company is in the following year. So roughly $600,000,
$700,000. And so the total is?
I'm not that good.
3.25 million.
Okay, thank you. So what remains to be seen, that's the cost, 3.25, and now we have to ask ourselves what we got for it. Thank you.
Happily argue very little.
Senator Boquist.
No, we just passed the bill and then we won't have to argue about it. What we'll get is less argument about this issue.
We've been at this for, I don't know, 4 years?
More or less.
More than, actually, yeah.
More than
we started, we started before that too.
Mm-hmm.
Before we even got to what we did that we didn't do right.
Yeah.
Got it. Yeah.
You, Representative, have spent more on your side on this bill than you deserve to. And you're ahead of us on this, so we thank you for your work, not just this session, but last session as well. I think Senator Benz was on this team, too.
Was.
And so thank you. And thank you, Mark, for coming up.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Senator Benz.
Thank you. I almost hate to ask if we should go back and look at what we estimated the cost would be when the bill was passed. Do you think we called out that it would have cost us $3.2 million? Did we have a revenue impact those years ago that said $3.2 million on it? I remember that bill extremely well because I spent an entire weekend taking that bill apart as it moved from the Senate over to the House, literally, and recognized the challenges that were within the bill, political situations being as there are, and the Senate always having its way, as it should.
You've come around to that.
Yeah. The more they were to agree on it, it's good to know. That's right.
Chair, I mean, the one thing I would say, I wouldn't be surprised if the revenue impact statement were a heck of a lot higher, because originally, recall, we were talking about, disallowing Google's intangible assets against their tax costs forever. It started out at 20 years, but then we decided that wasn't long enough. And so I believe we made it forever. So I think the revenue impact statement was probably a bit higher.
The Senate decided.
Good point. The Senate decided.
Yeah, it was in the double digits. It was in the higher double digits, too, by the time before it got done.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Google pulled out, it basically pulled the rug out from under. I mean, that we got or didn't get doesn't matter. It's just the original forecast to put this massive ring around Portlandia was in the double digits. So.
And Senator Haas, if I may, Senate Bill 611 did quite a bit, and so all of the different components would have been included in the revenue impact statement. Senate Bill 611 clarified that data centers were locally assessed, which I think has been very successful at getting these constructed in Eastern Oregon. It put a cap on total intangible property that can be taxed for a company, which I think will give certainty to some large companies out there that, while they're not being centrally assessed today, they could be centrally assessed in the future. And just knowing that there's some cap on what they would pay, I think there's some value to that for not stopping people from investing. And it also changed the way that that we already had an exemption for FCC licenses. It added an exemption for satellites, franchises. So it tried to level the playing field between different types of companies. And so all of that would have been wrapped up in that revenue impact. But to Representative Smith Warner and Senator Boquist's point, the big thing was that we were trying to incent Google to come. And so I think that if you would have included that amount, it would have been quite large. But at the same time, they had said that they would never come to Oregon if they didn't have this certainty. So that was...
But four.
Yeah, I don't know how you would actually measure that, but it's complicated for sure.
Good perspective. Thank you. All right. Thank you both. Mr. Johnson.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The revenue impact statement is a positive, and as you'll remember, this is a property tax exemption, so these are revenues that would now be positively flowing to school districts, counties, cities, and special districts. The League has been working on this bill since 2015 when 611 passed, so we're strongly in support of the bill to end the story. But I was going to echo what Mark Garst said. Of this, 611 was my first bill with the League on property taxes, and Chair Haas, you worked on that tirelessly. The rest of the bill is still intact. This was a small portion of it. The data center piece, the cap, the dealing with the telecommunication companies generally, because the court decision had issued in 2014, and so we needed to respond to that as it related to cable. All of those parts have remained intact, and so it's just a small portion to deal with the potential of Google that just didn't quite work. And we have strongly supported broadband incentives generally. This incentive just didn't quite work, and so we'd ask again for your support. The history is long and involved, but I think we're there, and we just think it's a good bill, should pass.
Thank you. Questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Committee, we are in work session, and I'm open if you need more time or this torture needs to stop or where you are. You okay? Anybody need more time?
Well, I love torture, but not today.
Anybody need more time? Or you?
I'm just waiting for the good, vice chair down there to do something so we can end this.
All right, Senator Benz.
Chair, we are talking about 2684-A. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes.
Chair, I move House Bill 2684-A to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Benz moves House Bill 2684-A to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Boquist?
Yes.
Senator Riley?
Aye.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz?
Yes.
Chair Haas?
Haas votes aye. Senator Benz, you have a unique specialty in this particular area. You have spent more time on this particular concept than the rest of us. Would you mind carrying this bill?
I would be happy to carry it, Mr. Chair. I will have to call out responsible parties, but sure.
It was the Speaker's pet bill that year. I just want to point out to you, so not the Senate.
I close the public hearing and work session. And I will open up a public hearing and a work session on Senate Bill 48.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 48 deals with the historic property tax exemption. And so if you have property and would like to apply for it to be considered historic property, there's a program in which that you your property can retain a frozen value for 10 years, and there's some sort of sideboards around the program. So one of the parts of the program, for instance, that was, I think, set in place in 2009, is that in order to do this, you must specify a plan of rehabilitation and restoration of the property that includes 10% of the value of the property. So sort of this idea that you're investing a large amount in your property, that could trigger reassessment normally, and in the case of historic property, you would have your property value frozen. So that is currently in statute. It's up for sunset, and this would extend out the sunset to from 2020 to 2023, but there is a dash one, and that moves the sunset date to 2022.
Okay. Peggy Moretti, you're going to bring your team up here.
Good afternoon, Chairman Hassan, committee members. I'm Peggy Moretti. I'm the executive director of Restore Oregon. Restore Oregon is a statewide nonprofit dedicated to saving Oregon's historic places. I have submitted written testimony, but I thought it might be helpful just to share a few remarks. I can share from my own personal experience. I have taken advantage of the special assessment on my own property, but I also work with folks all over the state who are trying to figure out how to find the resources to restore and adaptively reuse historic properties of all different types. One of the points I like to make about something like special assessment, it's a very modest incentive, and frankly, it's I honestly believe we have other more creative ways that we could be supporting restoration and reuse across the state of the places that embody our heritage, but they may not be very possible for us in the current tax credit climate. So this is the only statewide accessible to everybody incentive that exists in Oregon. And we actually, as a state across the other 50, we have the fewest, poorest economic incentives for historic preservation and the economic revitalization that goes with that. So I think it's a very worthy financial mechanism to extend. I think it's important to note that I think some folks are kind of thinking maybe there's developers out there that would do these projects without them. And that may be true in one or two instances. But by and large, this is the one incentive that is accessible to regular small property owners that aren't developers, that aren't, don't have a team of lawyers and folks that are helping them figure out how to do these projects that bring their neighborhood or their community back to life. And for that reason, I think it's something that we really do want to make sure that we hold on to so that those small mom and pop kinds of operations can get a little bit of help, a little bit of relief on the very, very significant investment that it takes to bring a historic place back to life. I know in my own experience, probably the bit of property tax relief I have been benefited by on my own old fixer-upper house maybe amounted to less than 20% of what we have invested. But that ability just to get a little bit of help back encouraged my husband and I to go ahead and dive in and do it, you know, that there was just a little bit of relief that would come to us. And we see that at Restore Oregon in cases all across the state. There are folks that are really trying to step up and bring these places back to life, whether it's an old house in a neighborhood or a storefront on a main street. These kinds of things just really can make that incremental difference that gets something over the hump. So I'd be very happy to answer any questions, but I just do urge that you pass this extension and appreciate your consideration of that.
Thank you, Peggy. Question. We have in the Senate, in the Joint Tax Expenditures Committee, Senate Bill 929.
Yes.
Which is a tax credit for historic preservation.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Something which our organism very enthusiastically supportive of. Yeah. We recognize that that's a little bit of an uphill climb, probably, and that, in my opinion, a historic tax credit is a better mechanism for incentivizing investment in historic restorations and adaptive reuse. And I think that's one of the I think my friends in the Historic Preservation Office, who, by the way, do a wonderful job of administering this, a very thoughtful, attentive job to making sure this is well used. I think we would all agree that there are other ways we could be looking at the goal of, you know, of restoration and reuse, but we need to have the opportunity to put that strategy together. That's why I think there was just instead of a full 6 or 7 year extension, the suggestion was to just do a shorter one while we can buy ourselves a little time, maybe to be in a better position to embrace a more robust tax credit plan. I'm hoping we can still do a little something with that bill, but it wouldn't probably reach a size and scale in this session that would have a huge impact, I'm thinking.
Yeah, I think, well, there's two things. And I do remember hearings in this room, and I can't remember if it was on the tax credit side or not, but where developers explained to us, thinking they were helping their cause, that they would have built these buildings anyway because they love these old historic buildings with or without the credits. And the second point is, someone might wonder, do we need both approaches, a property tax exemption or a tax credit, or
right.
Maybe we do.
I think the different tools for different situations are appropriate. We could segue into a whole different discussion on the tax credit bill and the way that is structured, which I'm very intimately familiar with. First of all, that would not help residential properties. Basically looking at commercial and apartments and housing and things like that and seismic. But I think you can definitely make an argument for both. Most states do have both a historic tax credit and property tax or other incentives, and they get to be applied in different situations. Sometimes you get to pick either or, depending on what works best in a particular situation. And assuming that any tax credit program would be capped, and I'm assuming it wouldn't be a super high cap on that, that would mean there'd just be a few projects that would qualify in any given biennium. So in either case, there'd be significant limitations placed on that.
Questions? Well, one thought that has come up was, we give you 2 years instead of three, and we shuttle this over to the tax expenditure committee, which in a few weeks will determine, we'll go down the list and determine what lives, what dies. And there's always been support for this if it's, you know, done the right way and not too over the top and not helping developers who would have developed condos anyway.
Right.
So your thoughts on that?
Two versus a three-year extension. I support whatever is politically palatable. I wouldn't split hairs over that. I think it's too soon to let it go because we don't have a good replacement for it at this time. And but I can commit to you that on the kind of the private nonprofit side of things, we're really actively looking to continually improve and come up with better and more creative ways to achieve the goal of preserving the places that matter here in Oregon. So, but right now I don't want to let go of this until we have those other options available.
I guess it's time for the committee to talk amongst itself. Senator Benz.
Mr. Chair, I just had a question about your written testimony. I was just looking through it, and it says that you had acquired the fixture-upper you referenced earlier, and then you would have applied for the freeze. Is that correct?
We
and
did.
And then 10 years go by, and then the property is reassessed.
Yes.
Your letter actually says over 13 years we estimated savings in the property taxes, but was it just 10?
Well, it's a 10-year term now. When my husband and I first came onto the plan and we're about to roll off, it was a 15-year plan at that point. It was a 15-year term, and so I was part of the 15-year class, I guess, you know, if you want to talk about a class of folks. So I believe my property rolls off next year, I think.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Senator Benz.
So as a result of the freeze and the designation, you did a whole bunch of work to the house. Mm-hmm. So the day of reckoning will be a year from now?
Yeah, we'll get a big reassessment. And honestly, I have heard that sometimes a person may have been better off not going on special assessment because of the incremental caps on how much your property can go. It depends. You're kind of playing a game a little bit as to how will something trigger a reassessment in between based on the work you've done. I'm not an expert on that, to be honest. But yeah, my husband and I will have a significant bump in our property taxes when we roll off. We'll get a brand new bill, and it will be significantly higher. But it has been helpful. I mean, it's it can be really daunting to tackle a rundown but important place. And I think it's worth mentioning that this isn't just any old house or any old building. It has to be significant enough to be on the National Register. So that means it's something that collectively is meaningful for us as in our community or a state to make sure doesn't become demolished or, you know, passes a point of no return in its condition. So, you know, we looked at this house, and when we took a big swallow and said, okay, yep, we're going to tackle this because we loved it. And we thought, well, there'll be a little bit of relief here. And it was very helpful, but it was a tiny fraction of what we actually did invest in it.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Senator
Benz. Right. So it has, and this is probably a question actually for staff, do we have a study that addresses this, the exact issues the witness is discussing? Because obviously we would like to know if this is a good deal for the state, given the types of facts we just heard on a 10-year program. And you can see how you'd have to sit there and run the numbers, look at the people that are doing it, how much was lost during the period of the freeze, how much was gained by virtue of the new reassessment. I mean, for us, we're just guessing. At least I am, and perhaps there's something in the materials I haven't looked at that answers this question. Is there any such study that calls out the true cost to the state, if any, as a result of this device?
Senator Benz and Chair Haas, members of the committee. So we're working with the Department of Revenue on that, and we have a revenue light available for this bill today. In working with that, we've found that in recent years about half of the applications are commercial applications and half are residential applications. And remember that this is a 10-year program. So in trying to construct the idea of what the revenue impact is to the state, you see the impact 10 years out. And so looking at that the interim and also the long term is something that we're working through with the Department of Revenue.
And Mr. Chair, is that right? When might we see the result?
I would expect this week or this coming week. But
okay,
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hess. I just wanted to express my support for the bill. I think this is a great program and a great idea. If people are willing to come forward and invest using their own money largely in these properties, and then we turn around and provide some assistance, but I would think that we're gaining so much more because then we're preserving these properties, and I'm not sure what would happen to them in some circumstances. They would probably just continue, and they may just fall apart, and then they would have to be torn down in some cases. And so I personally value preserving historic properties, and there's criteria that has to be met. It's not as if any old building or house can just qualify. So if that were the case, that would be a different story. But because there are sideboards on it. And according to the city, at least I was looking up through the testimony here, and at least in Portland, there are about 350 designated historic buildings that are built on, you know, that are falling within this. So it's not as if this is a huge number we're talking about, at least in Portland, for the number of structures. I'm just reading off of this. I don't want to be quoted on that, but I just wanted to let you know, Chair Haas, that I'm supportive of the measure.
Thank you. Senator Riley.
So if someone could remind me how you get a property on the National Register.
And Chrissy Curran here from SHPO knows this infinitely in infinite detail, but my experience, and as we kind of coach folks who come ask Restore Oregon for advice, which we frequently do receive, you have to demonstrate that it is historically significant, and the significance can come in different forms. It could be significant architecturally, it could be significant because a very important historic event took place there. It could be cultural history and significant. It could be for archaeological reasons. So it's not only about pretty architecture. It's about what took place or what is embodied in that place. And it's a process that you have to document and prove. And you write it up, and you spend a lot of effort vetting it through at both the state and then at the federal level. It goes through multiple rounds of review, and then that designation happens based on meeting all of those criteria and making your case.
So Forest Grove is in my district.
Mm-hmm. I know.
And as you well know, South Forest Grove has many historic houses, and it's interesting your name is so close to the Morellis, who...
Yeah. I get asked that sometimes.
Yeah, they're very big on the historic. At any rate, there's almost as many, I think, in Forest Grove as there are in Portland, but it seems that way anyway. So it doesn't seem all that hard to get on the historic record. So,
well, I didn't find it easy. I mean, when you look at the percentage of old buildings that are on the National Register, I wish I could actually pull that number out of my back pocket. But it's if you looked at, okay, here are the buildings that are old enough to be on the National Register by compared to how many are. I think it's 2%. I would be just my guess. I mean, it's a tiny fraction.
I get that, but out of the old buildings, but what percentage of it is of the people who applied?
Oh, that they were able to apply, you mean?
No. People who applied, were there any turned down?
I think there's probably very few that get all the way to the end of the process because there's a weeding out as you go along. The representatives from the State Historic Preservation Office who manage that process could speak to that more definitively, but there's a lot of ability to self-select and go, I don't meet that criteria. It becomes pretty obvious once you dive in. And because it is so much effort, it's not like fill out a form and submit it. I mean, this is some serious research and documentation you have to do. That discourages kind of, I want to say, non-worthy properties from going through it.
I'm not opposed to the bill. I'm just trying to figure out, you know, what we're getting into.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right, no further questions. Thank you, Peggy.
Thank you.
Committee, the choice really is to act on this bill one way or the other in our committee, which we cannot do today because we don't have the full revenue impact statement, or to refer it to the Joint Tax Expenditure Committee, which we can do today because we have revenue light. And
my preference, move it to
Joint Committee.
I don't care. What does Senator Vance want to do?
Senator Vance?
Well, I think it belongs in the Tax Credits Committee. That's where I think it belongs. So
okay.
I would support that.
Okay.
Okay.
Vote on as it is, but if you want to send it there, I will support that as well. Chair Hess.
I'm not committing.
Yes, we are.
I think it is more appropriate there, and I think we could look at it against, together with the other tax credit bill too, not to play them, compete against each other, but perhaps they complement each other, so.
So why don't we do that
then, Senator Benz? That would be a motion to have a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures. And we will leave the amendment off and just do straight bill.
So, Mr. Chairman, I move SB 48 for the past recommendation with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Tax Credits. Is that correct? That's all right.
Yes.
Senator Benz moves. Senator Bill?
Tax expenditures.
48, floor of the Oregon State Senate with a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures.
Yeah.
Be added. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none? So ordered. Okay. Clears our calendar today. Thank you, everyone. We will adjourn.